Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review in for the spring-breaking Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Ian, Republicans almost beat Harry Reid in 1998 by less than 500 votes he hung on to his Senate seat. In 2010, it looked like the Tea Party wave was going to take him out. But no, Harry Reid won and actually won quite comfortably against Sharon Angle. But in 2016, Harry Reid will not be victorious. Not because Republicans will beat him, but because Harry Reid is not running for re-election.
But this accident has caused us, for the first time, to have a little downtime. I have had time to ponder and to think. We've got to be more concerned about the country, the Senate, the state of Nevada, than us. And as a result of that, I'm not going to run for re-election. The decision that I've made has absolutely nothing to do with my injury. It has nothing to do with my being minority leader. And it certainly has nothing to do with my ability to be reelected, because the path to reelection is much easier than it probably has been any time that I've run for reelection.
So 30 years and done for Harry Reid. Ian, obviously we're going to get somebody like Chuck Schumer or Dick Durbin. Some folks now even saying Elizabeth Warren. So there's going to be a definite antagonist as the Democratic leader. But for a guy who constantly cheer-led, it seemed like, against the Iraq war, even in the most difficult times of the war, and is known for kind of his odious way up on Capitol Hill, just seeing Harry Reid gone is a happy thought for conservatives today, it seems.
That's right. I thought you were going to start the show with, you know, the Hallelujah Chorus or something like that, a little clip. Harry Reid says in that ad that he's had some time to ponder, and he believes the best thing for the country is his not being a senator. So we finally found something I can agree on Harry Reid with. I'm not sure how the Democratic leadership struggle is going to play out. It would seem Dick Durbin is the whip, but Chuck Schumer is probably the likely candidate. In any case, it is good in this regard that Harry Reid is, and I say this with all due professional respect, a pretty nasty individual and has been on the Hill, but that nastiness has made him extraordinarily effective. If you look at the most influential people in on Capitol Hill for the past several decades, Reid has to be right up there at the top of the list, including perhaps most importantly, pushing through Obamacare. You know, we have Harry Reid in large part to thank for that, as the case may be. We're going to get someone like Chuck Schumer, who might not be as you say, odious a character, but who is likely to be equally politically savvy. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily a tactical gain, but it certainly is good riddance for someone who is just a thoroughly dislikable character.
Certainly the case. No tears on the right, certainly, today with the announced retirement of Harry Reid. And now that makes three Democratic retirements and one Republican retirement going into the next cycle. And Republicans, of course, still playing quite a bit of defense, but the Democrats at least have to play some, even though California and Maryland are pretty likely, I would say, to stay Democratic. Harry Reid's seat, I think, could be more competitive than he's letting on, particularly if Governor Sandoval is interested in the seat.
That's right.
And obviously, Indiana's Dan Coats is the one Republican who announced earlier this week, actually, that he's not going to seek another term. All right, on to the bad martini now. And this is one that got a lot of attention yesterday, but it's so bad it deserves even more attention today. This is the Washington Free Beacon version of the story. The Obama administration is giving in to Iranian demands about the scope of its nuclear program as negotiators work to finalize a framework agreement in the coming days, according to sources familiar with the administration's position in the negotiations. U.S. negotiators are said to have given up ground on demands that Iran be forced to disclose the full range of its nuclear activities at the outset of a nuclear deal, a concession experts say would gut the verification the Obama administration has vowed would stand as the crux of a deal with Iran. Until recently, the Obama administration had maintained it would guarantee oversight on Tehran's program well into the future and that it would take the necessary steps to ensure that oversight would be effective. The other key point here is that concern from sources familiar with U.S. concessions in the talks comes amid reports that Iran could be permitted by the United States to continue running nuclear centrifuges at an underground site once suspected of housing illicit activities, and by underground meaning pretty much impervious to bombing. So as Jim said in one of his last morning jolts before vacation here, Ian, it's hard to imagine what the Iranians got talked down from other than a nuclear facility on our own soil for the sake of saving the shipping costs.
That's exactly right. So we're to believe that Iran needs centrifuges and impervious underground bunkers so that they can do medical research. Yeah. Start from the premise that we might want to negotiate with Iran, which I would disagree with, but let's even presume that that's the case. You would think that we would want to get something out of it, but we're getting nothing. Even as you point out, these very lax strictures that we were even contemplating putting on, it looks like the administration is giving up. There's no deal here. It's just giving Iran what it wants. This is what you get when the administration is not interested in anything but building its legacy. This is the type of deal that prompts what we've seen in Cuba. A couple weeks ago, it was that Raul Castro came out and said, well, the United States is doing all these really nice things for us, like reopening its economy, which would be a huge boon for a country that's effectively underwater. But we're not really sure that they're giving us everything we want, so we're going to... At what point does an impoverished communist dictatorship get the whip hand in a deal? Only when our administration has already effectively said, you can have whatever you want. That's exactly the same thing that's happening in Iran. This has nothing to do with preventing an Iranian nuclear weapon. It has everything to do with the Obama administration getting some sort of his so-called historic diplomatic victory. That's extremely harsh because it makes it sound like the Obama administration doesn't care about our security, but there's nothing in any of these dealings that indicates otherwise.
The thing that just always comes back to it for me is we should be the ones with all the leverage here.
Absolutely.
There are crippling economic sanctions here, and they should have been the ones begging for a deal, but then we ease the sanctions just for the purpose of talking in the first place, and now it looks like they're going to walk away with the whole store. And ultimately, I think it's going to be kind of tough for them to contend that this is a deal where there's still some sort of verification involved. But ultimately, I think their argument's going to come back to what the president said in the State of the Union. If you don't like the deal, you want war.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very effective rhetorical tack. At least one small silver lining is that we've seen Democrats on the Hill saying this deal is going to go through Congress and sort of bucking the administration on that, which is nice to see. We'll, of course, see if it actually happens or not.
Well, the Democratic approach to Iran did not make you scratch your head or bang it on the table in front of you. Let's move to the crazy martini now, because California Democrat Barbara Lee is our focal point here. You may remember her from a number of years ago. She was the only person in Congress to vote against using military action in Afghanistan after 9/11. So that's your premise for jumping off here. But on Wednesday, Barbara Lee proposed a resolution in the House of Representatives that claims women will eventually be forced into prostitution in order to obtain life-sustaining food and water for their families. Yes, climate change will be responsible for this. Quote, women will disproportionately face harmful effects from climate change. Women will have limited socioeconomic resources and may be vulnerable to situations such as sex work, transactional sex, and early marriage that put them at risk for HIV, STIs, unplanned pregnancy, and poor reproductive health. So, Ian, I guess the evaporation of Florida's coastline, the polar areas just completely evaporating is not enough. Now we're essentially saying that if the temperature raises a degree over the next century, prostitution is going to be rampant globally.
It's nice to see the Democrats have finally realized the problem with climate change, which is sexism. It's extraordinary. It's predictable, and it really is nice because it sort of brings together a lot of the lunacy of the progressive left. And let's take note that Barbara Lee is a congressman from Oakland. So she's right in the thick of the looniest of left-wing loons. But in this resolution, you get both the left's obsession with drastic measures, you know, economically crippling, et cetera, measures to deal with climate change. And then you get their obsession with issues of sex and gender. So they get to bring it all together, and it makes for a really nice little rhetorical basket in which they can now beat Republicans over the head with being not just anti-science, but anti-women. So, you know, perhaps rhetorically it's effective, but it's it's just nonsense. This disparate impact, disparate treatment idea might be useful in statistical analysis in sort of sociology, but it's this fantastically vague term of art that we now just get to throw around and apply to everything, to show that if there's any sort of inequality, whatever the case may be, and I'm not even, you know, saying that is the case here, we get to ascribe some vast discriminatory intent and impel government bodies and bureaucracies and the people and all the rest to take drastic charge. So there's just a whole lot of not just dishonesty, but manipulation and silliness embodied in this. And hopefully Congress will respond accordingly.
Ian, do you get the sense that the more the projections from whatever 10, 15 years ago about what would happen if we didn't do something drastic on climate change, since those aren't coming true, we just got to keep throwing more onto the fire here?
That's exactly right. And actually, one of the interesting things you see is a change in terminology. We've gone from global warming to climate change to now weirding, the weirding of weather, which is wonderful because, you know, anything fits under the umbrella of weirding, droughts and the non-existent hurricane season of the past couple of years. And you hear these representatives attributing record summer heat to global warming and then record winter cold to global warming. I mean, it's perfectly nebulous. And that's precisely the reason that we ought not to be taking any serious measures against it.
That's the other treaty that the administration will be pursuing this year that it doesn't
indeed,
think the
indeed.
Senate has any review power in whatsoever, regardless of what Article 1 of the Constitution says. So great to have you with us, Ian. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join Ian and me on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.